Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics, nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov, which, according to this press release right here, Rich, has been named one of the 2025 best law firm rankings by Best Lawyers. Congratulations, sir. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Since our last episode, the United States has updated its government system to Trump 2.0. Here to talk about it, David Cole, the Honorable George J. Mitchell Professor of Law and Public Policy at Georgetown Law and former National Legal Director at the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. He writes about and teaches constitutional law, freedom of speech, and constitutional criminal procedure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Professor, it's been quite a jam-packed week so far in the 3 days since President Trump was inaugurated. Last month, in preparation for the inauguration, you were featured in The Atlantic in a piece entitled The Case Against Despair in Trump's Second Term, where you said that the ultimate protector of the U.S. Constitution is a civil society. Can you please explain what you meant by that?
Sure. I mean, the argument I made there is the constitutional system is predicated on checks and balances that are designed to restrict what a president with overweening ambition can do, and it's a lot harder to actually accomplish things than it is to say you're going to accomplish those things. There are checks in from the judiciary, checks from Congress, checks from federalism and the states. But ultimately, and many of those checks operated the last time around to limit the damage that Trump was able to do in his first term. He lost more cases in the Supreme Court than any president since FDR and in the lower courts as well. And Congress didn't do most of what he wanted it to do. He tried to repeal Obamacare about 15 times, failed every time. But, and this is the but, those structural systemic checks only work if people are organized, speaking out, protesting, engaging through civil society, through the Sierra Club and the ACLU and the Legal Defense Fund and you know, the League of Women Voters, you name the organization, but fighting back collectively against a president like this. And so, you know, I think that's what ultimately will determine whether Trump is able to do what he wants to do or not.
I mean, it's a really interesting take because, you know, quite simply, isn't the Constitution, regardless of whether there are people there to enforce it, right? I mean, shouldn't we trust that the executive branch reads the 14th Amendment, for example, and applies it with regards to birthright citizenship? That's been the law for, you know, for over 150 years. Rather than, to your point, there has to be a club or a group that enforces it, or shouldn't we have a president that abides by the law with regards to the January 6th people rather than pardoning them? So, I mean, I understand the point, but it's the Constitution after all, right? Shouldn't it be a self-enforcing mechanism?
Well, it is the Constitution after all, but it's not self-executing. And I think the reason that the framers did, in fact, separate powers and create checks and balances was that they understood that you can't just rely on the good faith of a president to limit his own actions to what the Constitution authorizes, or Congress to limit their own actions. Everyone who exercises power is going to be tempted to sort of go to the limits. And so you need checks and balances to keep that in place. So, yeah, you know, any sane president would not have issued that birthright citizenship executive order, which has, by the way, already been enjoined by a federal judge. The ACLU filed a case within an hour of his issuing that executive order. Is blatantly unconstitutional, but he wasn't willing to, you know, listen to read the law, listen to what the courts have said. And so the courts will now have to tell him we meant what we said. But they will, I think. But if everybody sort of sits back and says, oh, me, oh, my, you know, the president was elected and he wants to do these crazy things and it's overwhelming and there's no point in my getting involved. Then he will get away with a lot of the things that that he shouldn't. And you see that in other countries. You know, every country has a constitution now. Many of them look on paper just as good as ours. But without that kind of robust civil society, without engaged citizenry and the kind of civil society organizations that we have here, those constitutional constraints aren't so meaningful.
So, Professor, what about other elements of the immigration and U.S. border policy? For example, the mass deportation. You just mentioned that you didn't think that it's going to be viewed as constitutional, the whole issue with respect to birthright citizenship. But what about his promised mass deportation program, which he's already started mobilizing this week?
Yeah, so that we'll see. I mean, he's got a lot of discretion with respect to immigration, but the Constitution says that before you deport somebody, you have to give them due process. You have to give them a fair hearing, an opportunity to make their case, et cetera. That requires time. It requires resources. It requires immigration judges. We already don't have enough immigration judges. The immigration judges are so booked that you have 4 and 5 year delays in hearings on deportation matters right now. So unless he, you know, hires a whole bunch new immigration judges, it's going to be very hard to do what he wants to do. He is seeking to expand a provision of the law that gives the president the power to do what they call summary expedited removal, a sort of summary provision. He's seeking to expand that. The ACLU has challenged his effort to expand it. He sought to expand it last time around, and we challenged it successfully then. So, you know, we'll see. There are also significant Fourth Amendment constraints on the ability to do raids and the like. There are serious federalism constraints because states and local governments don't have to enforce federal laws. And I know Chicago, for example, has chosen to exercise that right not to enforce federal laws. That's for federal law enforcement officials to do. And that also is a constraint. So, you know, Biden deported more people than anyone previously in his last year, including Trump. So it's not like, you know, deportations have not already been going on at record levels. And I think what's really constraining going higher is resources, not, will.
Professor, just, you know, back to your point earlier, and the point of the article is, you know, we can have faith in the system. We don't have to despair in this next 4 years, or as Ryan mentioned, X number of days and counting, because there is a system of checks and balances, right? But it's hard not to despair when you know that system of checks and balances is tempered by the idea that he's got a 6-3 majority in the Supreme Court. He's got a majority in both houses of Congress. When you look at statements of even moderate Republicans in the last couple of days in response to some of what Trump has done, which quite frankly should just appall anyone, in my opinion, it's hard not to despair. Now, I know there, you know, these majorities were there in his first term, and there were some things that were accomplished. But just speak to the segment of the population that is in despair, given what has happened already in 3 short days and the lack of any real checks and balances seemingly by these two other branches of the government.
So, look, it is, you know, it is totally outrageous what he has done. It is deeply dispiriting that we're going to have spent 4 more years with a person who just has no respect whatsoever for the rule of law, for the values of our Constitution, who pardons people who brutally attack police officers, and in some instances, police officers who were killed. He pardons them all. I mean, it's outrageous. So I'm not in any way trying to to minimize how bad it is. My point is just we can fight back. We did fight back last time around. I think the checks and balances will serve our purpose if we engage them. So, you know, he has majorities in both houses. But in the Senate, you got to get 60 votes to get any legislation passed. So you have to get Democrats on board in order to pass anything. He was unable to pass almost anything the last time around because of that, even though he had majorities in both houses. Yes, he has a 6-3 Supreme Court, but that Supreme Court ruled against him. When he claimed that no one could subpoena his tax records, that Supreme Court ruled against him when he claimed just a month ago or so that he couldn't be sentenced for the felonies that he was convicted of in New York. And you know that they've shown some backbone, not enough backbone in my view, but some backbone. And if you look at the federal judiciary writ large, he's appointed about 25% of the federal judges, but Biden also appointed 25%, and Obama appointed 40%. So in your sort of cases you file in district court, you got about a 2/3 chance of getting a democratically appointed judge. Not to say that they all, you know, vote along those lines. It's also the case that a lot of Trump-appointed judges in the district courts in particular have been very good. We've won a lot. The ACLU has won lots of cases before Trump judges. Judges don't like someone who totally throws out the rule book and tries to upset the apple cart. They tend to be more establishment oriented, even the most, you know, sort of Federalist Society ones. Not all, but I still have faith in courts, in Congress, in the state attorneys general, and ultimately in the people. But as I say in that piece in the Atlantic, it ultimately depends on us.
Professor David Cole with Georgetown Law. Bigger story right now in Washington, new presidency or the Commanders in the NFC Championship?
Oh my gosh, that's a close call. Close call.
All right. Well, good luck to you this weekend. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, the greatest team in football history, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. Well, I'm watching live footage right now from Ventura County in Southern California. Cleanup is already underway, but those wildfires are still burning. Gerald Singleton is managing partner of Singleton and Schreiber Injury Attorneys in San Diego, here to chat with us about the next step for some of these victims. Thanks for coming on with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Barry, so you signed up dozens of victims of the LA fires within just a few days of that tragedy. Why was it important for you to move so quickly?
Well, in these types of fires, they take a long time to work themselves through the courts because there are so many people that are going to be filing suit. You're likely to have, you know, upwards of 10,000 people in the Eaton fire file suit. And so what's important is to get the process started so that we can get the discovery we need to demonstrate that Edison is liable, and also to get a trial date, because the trial date forces the defendant to either go to trial or to settle the cases. And for our clients, the most important thing is to get their case resolved. And so we want to speed that along.
Here is it just Southern California Edison that you mentioned? Is that the only defendant, or are there others? And tell us about your theory of liability.
Yes. So the only defendant right now is Southern California Edison. It's certainly possible there could be others, but that's who we're focused on right now. I'm sure you've seen the online videos that show an arcing event from the transmission lines down to the ground, and then the fire starting from there. So what we've done is we've had our experts, who are all former fire investigators who have now retired and now are private consultants, go out. They've been accompanied by investigators and experts for other attorneys, and they've done an inspection of the scene. And so what they found is that there's no other cause that could explain this. You don't have anything like a campfire. You don't have an encampment. You don't have fireworks. You don't have any of the things that you can see that are typical human causes. So you then look for any type of a natural cause, like a lightning event. There wasn't one. And then the other thing is they've looked at the actual towers and they've seen the markings that are consistent with that essentially arc of flame that we all saw on the videos. And so putting all that together, there's no other explanation that we have other than the video showing the arcing event coming down from the lines and starting the fire.
Barry, the defendant has stated that the cause is still under investigation. Talk to us about the challenges that you face as a litigant in discovering, gathering information at this early stage. Obviously, gathering that early is important. But what challenges do you face now? And then how do you think you'll overcome those through formal discovery if it gets that far?
Yeah, so the biggest challenge is they have access to the evidence and we don't. So the first thing we've done, and we've combined with all the other attorneys, is to formally ask them to lower the line so that our electrical engineers and other experts can look at them and determine if there are the telltale markings that indicate an arcing event. So in other words, again, we all saw that video. We want to establish that the video is genuine. So if we can look at that, then we'll be able to make that determination. It's a challenge in that SCE knows exactly what happened. They has access to the evidence, and we have to get that through the court process. And that's why it can take a little bit of time.
Sure, we've all learned that victims of the fire have some resources through the state, although they seem to be limited. Explain to us what the limitations are, if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that it works is that if you have insurance, then you have to proceed with insurance. There are some private entities. The Red Cross is wonderful. They get out. And they do a lot for people in these types of disasters. But if you are not insured, then you can go through FEMA. And sometimes the California Office of Emergency Services, OES, will have something similar. The problem is those are very limited. So you're looking at maybe 10 to 12,000 if you're a renter, 35 to 40,000 if you're a homeowner and you're uninsured. And while that certainly is better than nothing, it's obviously not going to be enough to get you back on your feet and replace what you have. And that's why for those individuals, the suit is really the only opportunity they have to recover.
Very last question. We really appreciate your time and your expertise during this time. We know you're busy. You've over the years of your distinguished career, you've handled many fire cases. You've represented thousands, if not tens of thousands, of victims of fires. Why is this one different, aside from just the sheer scope and the media attention? How is this one different from a legal perspective?
From a legal perspective, I think it'll be fairly similar to what we're used to seeing. But one of the things that's so unique about this is that Altadena was a unique community in Southern California. It was one of the only areas where there was an opportunity to have generational wealth for African-American families. And obviously, a large portion of those homes that represented that wealth have been destroyed. So that was one of the reasons that we're partnering with the NAACP to do everything we can to keep those resources in the community. We want to recover and we want to see that community rebuilt as opposed to people moving out in that community, which has been very strong for so long, disappear.
Jerry Singleton, thank you so much for joining us on LFO.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Drake is taking his beef with Kendrick Lamar to court over Kendrick Lamar's diss track, who, by the way, will be the Super Bowl halftime performer. The song Not Like Us. Kevin Cassini is a music attorney and advisor. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So, Kevin, last week, Drake sued Universal Music Group, which is the record label he shares with Kendrick Lamar. He sued them for defamation and harassment, alleging that UMG spread a false, malicious narrative when it promoted and released Kendrick Lamar's song, Not Like Us. Tell us more about this lawsuit.
Yeah, this is a federal action that stems from two preliminary steps that his legal team took in Texas and in New York that had outlined what looked like was leading towards a defamation suit, although maybe we thought state court, but also had some allegations of nefarious activities and fraudulent manipulation of streaming and maybe some under the table pay for play action on behalf of the Kendrick Lamar release that he said Universal had taken part of. This federal action looks like, although those claims remain there as allegations, assertions of fact, so to speak, they're not part of what's being asked to get redressed by the court here. So this is really now just a defamation action in federal court.
So talk to us about the action against the record label rather than Kendrick Lamar, because Drake is alleging that the label approved of this strategy and actually launched a campaign to create a viral hit that he says falsely accused him of being a pedophile and calls for retribution against him.
Right. I know if you read the complaint, I think it's 81 pages. It begins with a couple stories about how his homes were targeted by people trying to enact violence, gunfire. Even some of his security members were put in harm's way. So it has a real visceral effect. So says the story. I don't know if correlation and causation are the same thing, but the idea that's being put forward in the complaint is that because of the release and distribution of the track, and because of the promotion that followed, Universal stood to gain by, but B, by operating the way that they normally do, promotion of all their artists, they spread this malicious lie about him. And so he's trying to hold them responsible for the amplification of what really is the artistic expression of their other artist, Kendrick Lamar.
So, Kevin, I know that you were interviewed back before this lawsuit was filed and when Drake's legal team had taken those initial steps that you mentioned at the beginning of our interview. Do you think there's any there with any of this? I know that you had commented on the legal filings that were precursors, alleging payola and bots to boost the popularity of the track. Yeah. What do you think of all of this?
Well, I don't know if Universal engages in those practices, but if I presuppose that they do, it would be difficult for me to think that they've only done it for Kendrick Lamar. That questioning is actually addressed, though, in the story, so to speak, that is present in the complaint. Drake's legal team, whom I'm familiar with, they are very serious attorneys that take defamation actions very, very seriously. So they wouldn't do this if there wasn't a there, so to speak, or at least they didn't think they could get to some resolution. But what they're really doing here is, I think, trying to push forward an opportunity for him to maybe cast some doubt around the reality and the literal fact of what's being spoken about in the Kendrick Lamar song, but also maybe trying to take some shine off of that release itself, which, as you mentioned, may be featured during the Super Bowl at halftime, is up for a Grammy award at the end of next week. So maybe this is a chance to try to steal some of the limelight. I'm not really sure exactly. But it has been now in the new filing, you see that the Drake team at least asserts that his deal with Universal is up in 2025. And so maybe this is part of a renegotiation process. What they've alleged is that Universal engaged in these practices in a way to attempt to get leverage over him and kind of devalue him in the public eye so that when they do re-up, they wouldn't have to pay so much. Also, he alleges that because they have Kendrick Lamar under contract, but for a short period of time, that they use this timing in a way to prove to Kendrick Lamar that they could make him as big as Drake, so to speak, and that this manipulation of streaming and publication and promotion was part of that setup. I'm not really sure what more detail they have or what facts they have to prove that last part, but it's a strong allegation that wasn't really clear before.
I mean, you touched on a lot of interesting points here as it relates to this case, because, you know, this battle between them has gone on for years. You know, I don't know how much street credibility you have when the diss battle starts involving federal legal filings. You know, it's kind of hard to rhyme
well.
But, you know, you raise the idea of how it affects their public image and how it plays out on social media. You know, as much as this case is about perhaps the substance, which is rather unique, what is not unique is how this will affect their the public, the perception of them and record, you know, sales, right, and ticket sales in concert. We're about to cover the Justin Baldoni and Blake Lively case, which has some overtones to this because at the end of the day, they're going to be spending a lot of money and it's going to affect their futures, not just of the substance of the case. So talk to us about how that might play out with this kind of case.
Well, defamation claims when you're a public figure are really, really difficult to win, right? I mean, I guess it depends on how you define win. Perhaps shining light on what he thinks is an unfair practice, maybe stealing some of the publicity, is enough of a win for him. To win these allegations and get redress from the court, I find unlikely. You know, you talk about street credibility. I really can't vouch for it. I don't know what does or doesn't get it. This doesn't seem like, you know, a RICO allegation would be one thing that does. But this new filing has something that I find even more interesting and maybe more curious as it goes towards Drake's history with the culture and in his genre. The question really is, can you assert defamation if the speech is actually artistic expression, right? And if so, then you'd have to find a way that Universal is liable and Kendrick Lamar isn't part of this suit. In a way to overcome that issue, I'm not the only one that's going to ask that question. His team has led with and pointed out the fact that the Young Thug trial was at least in part based on a prosecution that found not just liability, civil liability, but criminal liability in also artistic expression, right? And I don't know if that's going to be a winning argument in court. We know how that trial played out, at least in part due to the fact that some of the evidence admitted shouldn't have been. But that certainly won't buy you any more fans or get you any more support, even amongst those people that maybe have been in your corner this whole time, pointing towards the use of rap expression as a reasonable legal basis for action. I don't think that's where he really wants to go.
Devin Cassini, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Have a great one, everybody.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We're joined today by Bill Himmelstein, the founder, CEO, and managing broker of Tenant Advisory Group, LLC, here in Chicago. And we have Derek Mullen, vice president and litigations manager at Seneca Insurance Company in New York City, both repeat guests. Thanks for coming on today, guys.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Rich, let's begin with Trump Watch. Already a lot of legal issues at play, including birthright citizenship.
We thought Trump Watch was going away, Tina. It's back. We could book it as our lead story for the next 4 years and beyond. Maybe 12 years of the next Trump presidency. Who knows? But a couple stories that are breaking. And the one that's breaking right now is that a judge just an hour ago said that Trump's order barring birthright citizenship is blatantly unconstitutional, which really is no surprise because it is, right? The 14th Amendment, which has been around a little while, says that if you're born here, you're a citizen. Trump put a halt to that. So that will, listen, all this is going to get to the Supreme Court. He's got a 6-3 majority. We'll see, to the point of our earlier guest, how willing the federal judiciary is to allow nonsensical anti-constitutional moves by our president to stand. Even though he's got a 6-3 majority, he appointed three of them that are the most, you know, some of the most radical ones, in my opinion. We'll see if they uphold this kind of nonsense. That's number one. Number two, what you know, shouldn't surprise anyone because he ran on it, but still is shocking. Only 2 days in, he pardoned these gangsters and hoodlums and crooks and people who assaulted police officers. on January 6th. We all saw it as the largest crime ever captured in American history. And he pardoned them all instead of doing what he said he would do, which was look at each case, case by case, and what his vice president said just a week before. It's like, of course we wouldn't pardon people who are engaged in violence. No, who would do that? What did Trump do? He just issued a blanket pardon to all of the January 6ers, basically saying, I don't have the time to do this case by case thing that I said I would do. Let's just pardon them all. And they've already come out and said they're going to do it again. They basically said, we're going to get retribution against those who made this happen. One of the leaders said, I want Merrick Garland in jail for 90 days. So you can't make this stuff up, really. But and that, by the way, the last story is like Biden is not, is not free of this either. On the way out, like at 11:30, while Trump was just entering the White House, he pardoned his family back to a weird specific date in 2014, which just adds fuel to the fire that there was a crime going on with his family. If you went back to a specific date, he also pardoned, preemptively people like Fauci. So, man, it's disheartening.
Yeah, it's a free for all, or so it seems. On the pardon front, I agree that, we're all watching this saying, could this really have been what was contemplated when the pardon power was given to a president? Probably not. But it sort of is what it is, right? And with respect to the birthright citizenship issue, obviously this is not over yet. It's only just started. For those who are supportive of it, the fact that the Seattle judge struck it down, great. I think it's a temporary restraining order of 14 days. So I'm sure we're going to see a lot more on this front in the coming days. I don't know. I mean, there's just a lot going on multiple fronts, Rich, across a number of different things, including, we're going to be seeing stuff on the reproductive rights front, I'm sure. The mass deportation, already seeing things, underway in Boston and most likely Chicago and elsewhere. So it's going to be busy.
Yeah, of course. Bill, anyone who listens to the show or watches it knows that, we try to be nonpartisan to the extent that we can. We want to voice our opinions, of course, and not everything that Trump has done or will do, I personally find to be a problem. But I don't know. I'd love to have someone come on and defend these pardons, right? I mean, it's the worst thing he's done, and he's done a lot of bad things. And it's only a couple days in, so I don't know. What are your thoughts on the pardon specifically?
Yeah, first off, I just think it sets a dangerous precedent that if you don't agree with an election result or any other policy for that matter that you disagree with, that you're allowed to violently try and overthrow the government or express your disagreement with violence. I also think it's a huge blow to the police who were attacked that were trying to protect the members of Congress. It's a blow to the prosecutors and judges that put these people behind bars. But I think even more impactful is the SCOTUS's recent ruling last year that grants sweeping immunity to presidents acting under official capacity. I believe that's a huge slippery slope that we will soon see put to the test.
Good point.
As we already are.
And just as we stay on Trump watch for a second, we just got guidance from the Associated Press, which is our kind of guidelines for the media. And it says the Gulf of Mexico has carried that name for more than 400 years. The Associated Press will continue to refer to it by its original name while acknowledging the new name that Trump has chosen as Gulf of America. So we're going to have to kind of navigate that over the next, we'll see how long we have to navigate that. But all right, moving along off of Trump watch. Kind of. Tina, Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson was at the inauguration. All of the justices were there, but she wore something that's getting a little bit of buzz.
Yeah, Ryan. So as we've been talking about throughout the show, it's been a jam-packed week the last 3 days since the inauguration. The reactions have been all over the map. It looks like for the Supreme Court justices, there's no exception, with Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson making news this week when she did something that some would say was channeling the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the inauguration, when she wore a judicial collar made of cowrie shells and a pair of matching earrings. The symbolism behind the jewelry is what people are talking about and framing it as maybe her attempt at quiet resistance. Cowrie shells were historically used as currency in many different countries around the world. And in African cultures, it signifies prosperity, protection, and is thought of as a totem to resist against enslavement. They're also seen as protective of womanhood and fertility. Given Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's views, this is no surprise, and her general opposition to the current administration's views on many issues, particularly since Rich, the inauguration fell on, of all days, Martin Luther King's birthday.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't think it's a good move. I don't like when any Supreme Court justice or any judge, for that matter, voices their opinion either overtly, like we've seen with many Supreme Court justices, or, you know, in this way. You know, the internet is strong. Everyone's gonna, within seconds, right? People are calling this out and understanding that it was not unintentional. It was a conscious decision. So, you know, I don't like it when she does it. I don't like it when Alito or Thomas accept gifts. I don't like it when this branch of government that is supposed to be nonpartisan voices their opinion. It's not what the judges are supposed to do. So I think it was a bad decision by her. And also, I mean, I don't like it at all. Derek, what's your thoughts on that?
I don't care one way or the other. I don't think it didn't bother me at all regarding what she was wearing there. People have a right to wear what they want to wear at these events. If she was, I'll be honest with you, I didn't even know that she was trying to send a message because I knew nothing about the attire that she was wearing. But look, my late father came to my wedding in sneakers and a T-shirt. So, you know, I really don't. It doesn't bother me one way or the other. You know, look,
what if she wore a pro-choice T-shirt? Would that be okay? That's wearing what she wants.
Well, let's be honest here. The Supreme Court is compromised anyway. I mean, it is what it is now. It's not the same as it was before. You got, you know, Alito there, you know, you got Clarence Thomas accepting all of these different gifts, and that's just as bad as somebody coming wearing a symbol. I mean, that's like somebody coming in wearing a cross. They come, you know, people are going to have different opinions about different things people wear. Yeah, it does send some sort of a signal, but I'm just telling you from my perspective, it doesn't bother me one bit.
Bill, it's true that, you know, faith in the Supreme Court is lower than any other branch of government. It's somewhere in the teens. So people don't believe, as Derek pointed out, and as I agree with, that the Supreme Court is nonpartisan. That's gone out many, many, you know, decades ago. And, you know, Samuel Alito on the other side, famously during one of Obama's State of the Union addresses, said the words "not true" while Obama was speaking. So perhaps this idea that these justices are supposed to be nonpartisan and non-expressive is a thing of times past.
I don't disagree with you, but, you know, my thought is she has the right to free speech for now, right? Pretty soon, I wouldn't be surprised if that you said something against Trump. You're not going to be allowed to say that. So we'll see. But he's already shown him trying to shut down fact-checking organizations and strong-arming people into promoting the message that he wants promoted is what's most important. So for now, she has the right to free speech. I can't say that that's going to be the same in the future.
It should be pointed out, Ryan, that about a year and a half ago, as we've covered, the Supreme Court put into effect a code of ethics that, you know, any plain reading that bars this kind of expression. That being said, no one's following it anyway. So, you know, why should she be bound to it, I guess?
All right, let's move away from D.C. Let's go down to Florida. Florida grandmother was on trial for the death of her granddaughter in a hot car. Rich, we got a verdict this week.
Yeah, we covered the story when she was arrested. You know, it was notable because this was the second time that under her watch, an infant that she was related to died. So this woman has, the defendant has a daughter, Tina. The daughter put one of their kids under her care earlier, and the kid drowned in the lake near their house. This second time, the same grandmother who was watching one of the other kids that her daughter had, her granddaughter, this time she left this infant, 7-month-old, in the car after returning home from lunch. The woman went into her house. She was practicing piano, and 2 hours later, she realized that this kid was trapped in this 90-degree car, and they couldn't, you know, the 7-month-old died. She went on trial for manslaughter in Polk County, and the jury returned a verdict of not guilty of that crime, but found her guilty of a lesser crime, which was leaving, you know, the child in the car. Sentencing is pending, but it could be as up to 5 years. Lots of interesting legal aspects to this story. I've heard some of the interviews. You know, interesting non-legal part of it, Tina, is that the daughter and the son-in-law of this grandmother, you know, they were asking for her to be convicted, right? I mean, they said that as an advocate for our kids, as a mother, they needed justice. She understands that it's awkward and she felt bad for the mother, but she was very, very strongly in favor of a finding of guilty in the higher charge. The grandmother's defense was that she was on Ambien. She continues to mount that defense and said she's going to appeal. And the family has a new baby, a 4-month-old. You know, suffice it to say that without, you know, trying to be funny, like they're not going to leave it with this woman anymore. But obviously a tragedy. You know, the idea that you should be charged for that without having the requisite intent is interesting. But yeah, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, Rich. I mean, I have to say that I was not particularly happy with the result here. I mean, it's just tragic. No matter what the legal result is, it's not going to bring any of these kids back. I think that it's really questionable to me that, I mean, the whole argument about being on Ambien, if you're on Ambien to the point where you are so, I guess you're compromised, your judgment, et cetera, is compromised to the point where you leave a baby in the backseat of a hot car, you probably shouldn't be getting behind the wheel of that car in the first place, if your judgment and your ability to function is that impaired. Yeah. So I also think it was really, I guess, in an attempt to forgive the grandmother that they put their second child in her care and then had this horrible result. It's just terrible. I just disagree with the result, Rich.
Agreed. And what's really interesting, Bill, another really interesting legal part of this is the jury didn't hear evidence of the first death. That was barred. I wonder, right, what the jury would have done had they known that this woman was responsible in many ways for the death of not one, but two infants under her care. You know, you would think that they might have come down differently, but it's not uncommon to keep that kind of evidence out. The judge, you know, reasoned that the prejudicial value was greater than the probative value. But probably, yeah. So what are your thoughts on keeping that evidence out?
Well, here's what I would say. First of all, we know that there are different legal consequences depending on intent, right? I think in my mind, what happened in the past is relevance. It shows a pattern of behavior. It shows, so maybe there wasn't intent, but we find that there's clearly some issues with this person who now has done this twice to two different children. But my thought is there needs to be consequences for people's actions, whether they meant to do something wrong or not. However, based upon all the presidential pardons, maybe there doesn't need to be consequences for people's actions.
Yeah. Derek, was this the right result or should she have been found guilty of the more serious charge of aggravated manslaughter?
Well, as I was reading the story, I said, OK, you know what? Older woman, she made a terrible mistake. But then when I got to the last part about it happened before with the kid drowning, I'm like, well, that's to me, that's a red flag there. And first of all, I'm just wondering, after the death of the first kid, who would, in their right mind would trust this woman to babysit and watch a second kid? So that was kind of mind-boggling as well. I believe that it was gross negligence. Now, in any court of law, they have to prove intent, that she intentionally leave that child in the car. And they couldn't prove that. But she was grossly negligent. And for 2 hours, that's what really bothered me. I can see if you forget something. People leave their phones in the car and they know right away that their phone is not, they don't have their phone. You're missing a child and you can't recognize that the child is not there. Something is wrong there. And I thought maybe something mentally was wrong with her there when she was on some heavy medications and she just forgot. But geez, people forget their keys and their phones and they'll go all the way back home from, you know, Manhattan to like Queens to get their phone. So this one here is really mind-boggling. as to how she did not recognize, and she should be punished. I look, the sentence should have been more severe than what it was. But, you know, they have to go by what the courts say. And if the intent wasn't there and it was gross negligence, they have to give out to whatever the max charges for gross negligence, homicide.
So you raise a point I hadn't thought about, which is, you know, to what degree of blame perhaps the jury put on the daughter, right, who left the kid for the second time in the care of this obviously, you know, incompetent woman. And you and I, in our practice, every day we deal with the issue of comparative fault and what percentage a jury is going to give. Perhaps the jury in their mind thought, yes, the grandmother was culpable, but we're going to apportion some of that fault to her daughter, who was also arguably not responsible for leaving her in there.
It's fool me once, shame on you. Yeah. Fool me twice, shame on me. I mean, I agree with you, Derek. There should be some responsibility on the parents there.
Yeah, I think that's true.
By the way, forgetting your phone nowadays is like forgetting to put your pants on. Like, you just feel lost, right? This point. Tina, Harvard has settled its lawsuits over anti-Semitism on campus.
Yeah, Ryan. So earlier this week, Harvard settled two of the lawsuits which have accused the university of violating the Civil Rights Act, Title VI, actually, which bars federal funds recipients from allowing discrimination based on race, religion, and national origin. These lawsuits were brought by Students Against Anti-Semitism and by Jewish Americans for Fairness in Education and the Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law. They were filed in the wake of the accusations against many major universities that they were encouraging anti-Semitism after the Israel-Hamas war broke out in October of 2023, resulting in many months of pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses across the country. Students have accused Harvard, as well as other universities, of selectively enforcing anti-discrimination policies, as well as hiring professors who promoted anti-Jewish violence and spread anti-Semitic propaganda. So under the settlement, without admitting any wrongdoing, Harvard has paid an undisclosed amount in damages, will provide additional protections for Jewish students, and they will adopt the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, particularly as it relates to putting together things like frequently asked questions, et cetera. They also have to report annually for 5 years on their enforcement efforts and provide anti-Semitism training to staff who review discrimination complaints. The organization Students Against Anti-Semitism has not yet settled its lawsuit, Rich, against Harvard, but they have settled litigation against NYU, and these and similar cases remain pending against other universities, including Columbia, Penn, as well as Berkeley. So, Rich, you know, this is, you know, resolution of one of any number of these lawsuits that remain pending.
Well, it's interesting timing. Number one, many people, I'm sending the code. There's a lot of people saying, many people are saying that, you know, Trump saying that he's going to hold these colleges and groups responsible in his administration led to this settlement. Number two, I thought that Harvard got off way too easy when you consider the settlement that Northwestern here locally was involved with pro-Palestinian protesters. I mean, they got a great deal. They got a center on campus. They got a bunch of scholarships devoted to their supporters. Harvard didn't give up nearly enough. And, you know, it's interesting. Speaking of Trump, Ellie Stefanik, who is Trump's nominee to be the American ambassador to the UN, you know, she really got that job because of billions of people looking at her grilling the former president of Harvard over this issue. And, you know, that president did a horrible job. So and that got her fired, by the way. So, you know, I thought Harvard got a little bit off a little bit easy. And this idea that we're going to go with this definition of anti, like, how hard is it to understand what anti-Semitism is? Just like anti-Muslim feelings or anti, you know, any racist. I mean, it's not that complicated. So I think it's an example of, you know, maybe a little bit overdone. I'm glad that Harvard got sued, but I wish they would have paid a little more from my perspective. Derek, what's your thoughts on it?
Well, my thoughts are, look, there was institutional control, which means that there was just no control on these campuses. It should have never gotten to this in the first place. I think they just had poor leadership in place. And you're right, Harvard did get off easy. The parties were satisfied with, you know, with the settlement, and going forward, they put in place, you know, anti-discrimination programs, more sensitivity training, et cetera. But it should have never gotten to this in the first place. And I agree that they did not get the same, they didn't have to pay the same price that Northwestern had to pay. So going forward, hopefully things change and it sends a message. And I do think that the incoming administration more than likely put a big scare into them. So they just get wrapped up and try to get this thing done. So going forward, hopefully things are better.
Bill, good result, bad result. Man, on the other side of it, is it going to have a chilling result on free expression? I mean, campuses should be areas of First Amendment free expression, right?
Well, absolutely. But I think the question is, what they were asking is, what is anti-Semitism? And my answer is to take a statement made about Jews or Israelis, turn it around and see if it offends or scares people. For example, if I were to say death to all Catholics and the Vatican should be destroyed, there is no doubt in my mind that that would be considered hate speech and I would suffer some consequences, right? We have rules and laws already against hate speech and crime and hate crime to protect minorities and smaller subgroups. So I know that if there's a large group of people that came out suggesting that all Christians or Muslims should be destroyed, there's lots of people would have a problem with that. So if we're going to try and protect people from hate like anti-Semitism, racism, sexism, ageism, or any of the protected classes, why should we stop short with any other group of people?
By the way, I want to point out regular decision college applications are due by mid-February. So as far as timing goes, maybe that played a little bit of a role. I'm not 100% sure, but just saying. All right. Australia has a new law meant to detach citizens from their phones. Rich, explain this one to us.
It's a right to disconnect law that was passed in Australia actually, several months ago. But what caught my attention, Tina, was that there are laws pending now in New York City and California that are similar, basically saying that you have the right to not respond to emails, calls, et cetera, after regular hours. But, I have to really double check the date on this story because it's not on trend. I mean, again, Trump, like him or hate him, is a dominating force in all across most areas of our life. And one of Trump's edicts so far has been, you have to show up for work. If you're a federal employee, by the way, he fired a lot of federal employees. That's subject to some, possible violations of labor law. But he said that if you're a federal employee, these days of working from home are over. He said it's part of this woke culture where you don't have to work very hard. You have to show up for work. So this idea that you have the right as a worker to disconnect is not on trend, I don't think. And I don't think it's going to have much momentum given the new paradigm we're living in. Where Trump's ideas seem to be, popular. Obviously, he won the election. So while it might be okay in Australia, I don't think these proposals to mirror this legislation in New York City and California, maybe California it'll pass. But New York, too, is very liberal. But I don't know. I mean, the big picture is, Tina, you and I, we all sort of work in this environment that you got to be responsive 24/7. That's how we all came up. I know Derek is a valued client of mine, and I got to respond to him whenever he texts me, no matter what time of day it is. So I don't follow the right to disconnect, but do you think it has any footing here in the U.S.?
Well, I think, that's a great question, Rich, and I read this story kind of through the same lens you did. We're in a services profession, especially when you get more senior and you run client relationships. You can't just disconnect because, there's certain of us, depending on your practice area, where it's like you need to almost wear a beeper. Like this is the 21st century version of wearing a beeper back in the day. When somebody needs you, you're needed in that moment. You usually can't punt it off. So while I do think that there are cohorts in the workforce where this may work in the U.S., I do think that when you start getting super granular about what people's jobs and responsibilities are, that there is a segment where this just simply would not work. And then it becomes a choice as to whether you as a person, a professional in the workplace and in the, and as part of the workforce want to partake in a profession where you are going to be accessible or need to be accessible beyond just a typical workday.
Bill, you got an opinion on this for sure. Is this wokeism gone amok, run amok?
Yeah, I feel like if you make the choice to take a job and get paid money to do that job, then You need to be responsible, right? It's just about taking responsibility. An athlete who makes millions of dollars, they have to show up to team practices, the flights, the team meetings, whatever it might be. They have to be at a certain place at a certain time, and they need to be available. So that's just what people sign up for. And if you don't want that, don't sign up for that job. Take a different job. Do something else. You know what? You can go work retail, and you know you still got to be there at a certain time, or you're not going to have that job anymore. The fact of the matter is, you know, you just got to accept responsibility. And if you don't want the responsibility, don't take the job.
Mullen, you oversee literally hundreds of lawyers across the country. Can you stop bugging me after 5 p.m.?
Look. Look, obviously, you know, there's exempt and non-exempt employees, right? So, you know, you would expect your non-exempt employees, if they're working over their hours, you got to pay them overtime, right? If you're an exempt, if you sign up, you're an exempt employee, you're basically, I look at it like, you know, you're a doctor on call, you're a surgeon. Nobody, you could be drinking at a bar. You get that call, you got to make that call back. Now, look, there's sensible things. Like, I mean, obviously on Easter Sunday, you don't want to be emailing your examiner saying, I need a status on this on Easter Sunday. You got to use some common sense here. So it's really, you know, we have cases and we have accounts. Some could be in Hawaii. Some could be in New York. But that Hawaiian person may be sleeping by the time you're working. By the time they wake up, they're going to send you an email. You know, you have to be responsive. That's your job. You're an exempt employee. You're being paid money. You're expected to respond. Obviously, you don't want to abuse somebody to where you're expecting them to work weekends and nights and, you know, and all types of hours and stuff. Then you're going to burn them out. So it depends on the situation. Obviously, a hospital worker is a lot more important than, you know, a garbage man, for instance. So, you know, if somebody's dying, somebody got to get to that hospital and then perform that surgery. So it like I said, depends on situation to situation. But in our industry, to answer your question, Rich, I do not expect you to respond on Christmas Day for a status request.
I'm Jewish, so it's just a Monday for me.
Yeah.
Call that Monday.
Yep.
All right. Well, we typically have Trump watch in the grab bag. Rich, I feel like in 2025 here, lively Baldoni watch will be kind of a staple. What's the latest here?
I thought the word Baldoni would be so frequently used in our podcast. But yeah, we've covered the story. It's one of the more interesting entertainment stories. Basically, these Blake Lively, the actor in this movie, It Ends With Us, has accused the director and also the star, Justin Baldoni, of sexually harassing her during the film, and then engaged in this PR, attempt to discredit her. He countersued, I think, for $400 million. Tina, saying that he was being defamed by the New York Times and by Lively and her husband Ryan Reynolds. What was released this week? And this, you know, it's all being played out on the media. Their competing attorneys are releasing lots of text, hundreds and hundreds of texts between the two. But also, very interestingly, this video. That really, you know, Baldoni's camp released this video. It's like, I think, 20 minutes or so of a scene in the movie where they're dancing. And what's interesting, Tina, is that it's really like much evidence in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
We're going to show the video here in a sec. He says the video shows that he wasn't inappropriate with her, that he was giving her direction, and that she was a willing participant by joking, by reacting the way she did. She said the opposite is true. It supports my perspective that I was a victim of sexual harassment and assault because he's touching me inappropriately. He's you know, talking about what I smell like. He's trying to kiss me instead of me talking. It's really interesting when you really get down to the fine details. And, you know, from my perspective, it's like, on the one hand, they're acting, and they're supposed to be acting in a movie where there's a couple, where they're a couple. So that supports his position. On the other hand, it does seem, if you listen to the audio and watch it, that he is joking around and he's taking it to a level that, from my perspective, shouldn't be done. So it really is interesting that this evidence, if it gets to trial, will be used for two different theories.
I agree, Rich. I watched the video also, and I try to watch it through the lens of both of their perspectives. And, you know, it was interesting because I sensed, I don't know if others who watched this sensed, that she did seem to get, there were flickers and moments where she seemed like she was getting uncomfortable during that video, especially when he leaned in to kiss her, when he started like sort of stroking her and, you know, and when he was, you know, touching her neck and things like that. And there were a couple of things that he said that just didn't really make sense to me. Like, it smells so good. Like, what, like, usually, like, when you say it smells so good, like, what is it? You usually say you smell good or that smells good, not it smells so good. So it's almost like, did he realize that he wasn't behaving appropriately? It's just, I agree, Rich. And I don't think that this is going anywhere anytime soon, to be honest.
Probably isn't. We can show the video for a sec. But on the other hand, in his defense, and I'm not defending him, but like, he's the director. And the point of a director is to try different things. When you're in a scene with someone who you're supposed to be romantically involved with, who's to say that rubbing your mouth up against her is okay, but kissing is not okay? That's like a take that you would try and maybe, you know, in the editing process, not use. So, I mean, it's hard to say that what he was doing on video is clearly sexual harassment when he's the director and they're supposed to be a loving couple or one that whatever. So, Derek, I don't know if you saw the video, but what are your thoughts on this story?
My thoughts on the story is that in any alleged sexual harassment case, that we have to take the allegations very, very seriously, and they should be investigated. And I don't know who's telling the truth here. I don't want to give an opinion on who I think is telling the truth or not. I think there's two sides of the story. It has to be investigated, and whatever the conclusion is, that's what the conclusion is. It is a different, it's somewhat of a different situation that, you know, were you instructed to do this? Did the producer say or director say, do this? Was Baldoni following direction here? So there's a number of different aspects here. And maybe there was some miscommunication there. I don't know. Maybe, you know, Baldoni wanted to do what he did. I don't know. But at the end of the day, we have to take sexual harassment allegations very, very serious. And if it's something that bothered Blake Lively, it should be investigated. And whatever the outcome is, that's what we'll have to live with.
All right, let's look at it really quickly for our viewers who haven't seen it. Yeah, so what we're looking at here is they're dancing, right? This is a scene where they're dancing and, you know, she's laughing. But again, Tina, the idea, you know, who knows where her character and his character begin and their real, you know, selves end. So it's definitely...
That makes it tricky, Rich, is exactly what you said, is that, you know, they're wearing multiple hats in this scenario. And so where does their acting end and where do they start wearing the hats of themselves out of character? Which is obviously part of the lawsuit, right? Is that, you know, Justin Baldoni is claiming, among many other things, that she was not with him as the director. She wasn't really taking direction. So
it just underlines the point that we talk about a lot. And those of us, you know, who litigate before jurors, you think that something might have a certain effect in a jury and it might have the opposite effect, right? And that's he released this and he thinks it supports the story. It arguably destroys his story. So it'll be really interesting.
And I just looked up one of the issues that she had was there was no intimacy coordinator on staff at that time. And I had to look up and see what that was. And that's a real thing. So there you go. All right. What's that?
Never had that on this show, maybe.
No. All right, let's wrap this up. Tina, I love this story out of Italy you picked out. Tell us about this new law there.
Yeah, Ryan. So Italy's clamping down and making it harder to leave reviews about things like restaurants and hotels in a first of its kind proposed legislation in Europe, which is fully expected to pass unopposed. And if it's passed, the new law is going to shift the burden to travel review sites like TripAdvisor to verify that anybody who is leaving a review about an establishment actually visited the spot and that they're not getting paid to leave positive reviews. The purpose is what you would expect, to try to protect entrepreneurs, small businesses, to curtail fraud and biased reviews. Any reviews would have to follow a certain format, and there would have to be a guarantee of truthfulness. There would have to be verification with a valid ID of the truthfulness and veracity of the review, and the reviewer would have to prove that they were actually at the establishment within 2 weeks of writing the review. Merchants would be given the chance to respond and to refute poor reviews, and they would also be given the opportunity to remove bad reviews after 2 years, even if they were truthful, assuming that they've addressed the problems. What's interesting, Rich, is that I think that in many ways we could use something like this here. The merchant associations in Italy actually don't think this goes far enough at all, saying that, you know, beyond review sites like TripAdvisor, that there should also be a focus on things like social media sites where a lot of the review type of communications to the public occur. So this was an interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on Legal Face-Off, we cover all corners of the globe, especially Italian legislation. That's one of our specialties here. But yeah, I don't know the downside to it. I mean, you know, we all rely on these reviews, but I think the value, who could rely on them? I don't know if the reviews are real, if they're AI generated, if they're paid for. I mean, it used to be where you could trust these reviews, but I don't know. I can't believe any of the reviews. I mean, you know, when you buy something on Amazon, are you going to trust that it's a legitimate review? I wish there was a way, and this seems to address it, to ensure that these reviews were legit. So I think it's a great development. Bill, Derek, what if we were reviewed personally? Do you think that would
be? You know, that's been a big driver of our business, is all of our Google reviews. But I think this is great. You know, who doesn't want more transparency in truth in what we read, right? Oh, wait a second. Maybe our politicians don't want that. So never mind. This probably won't work out here in America.
Derek, last word on this.
I'm one of the people who gets conned by reviews. So I look at her when I go to buy a product. I look at how many good reviews or bad reviews on a particular product, and I make a decision based on based on the results. But I do believe that there should be some transparency, because you never know. There's bad actors out there who could be paying somebody off to purposely downgrade a competitor. And just say this here, and say this here, we'll give you a $100 gift certificate, and they're saying bad things about a competitor. So you never know what the motive is behind these reviews. Look, I bought products before and gotten and done some reviews, but they've never gotten posted other than posting on Facebook. So it's really one where I do believe that there should be some guardrails, because you don't know where these reviews are coming from. You don't even know if the people have been there. I'm guilty of believing everything I read on these reviews. So anything that makes things better and more transparent, I'm all for it.
How many of you know your Uber star? Like, do you know what your rating is?
Well, I always read the Uber stars when I look at it.
You know, 4.74, which isn't great, I don't think.
It's not stellar.
I think
there's room for improvement, Rich.
Keep an eye on censorship in our country in the next couple of years. I think you're going to see that truth and transparency are going to be in the eyes of the judge here and the person who determines what is truth and what isn't. We're going to see a lot more of that. We already have. We'll see a lot more. And it's called censorship.
Speaking of the truth, we want to end our episode, as we do every time, with throwing a curveball at you that you didn't prepare for, dealing with one of our stories. So we talked about Blake Lively and Baldoni. Blake Lively, of course, was probably most well known for her time on Gossip Girl, that dealt with her time in a prep school. So let's go around the room and tell us, for one of us, by the way, this is going to be a layup, but tell us your favorite TV show, I guess, or movie, not Gossip Girl, dealing with high school people. So I love a good high school, but I don't like any show with kids below high school. So like Stranger Things, like, I can't take it. But once you hit high school, I'm all in on that show. So besides Gossip Girl, let's start with, and you can't say what someone else said. So we'll start with Derek Mullen. Now to be clear, I know Mullen's answer because he and I spend countless hours discussing this. Derek Mullen, what's your favorite high school show of all time?
Without a doubt, Beverly Hills 90210.
Here we go. Hills of West Beverly High. All right, 90210. Bill?
Oh, I was thinking movies, and it was Dazed and Confused, you know, when every once in a while I'll get told that I look a little bit like Matthew McConaughey. Certainly not in that movie, but, you know, his line about, as another one of his movies where he's like, all right, all right, all right. So it's, that's one of my favorite high school movies.
Quarterman, great first role, great intro by McConaughey. Ryan Burrow, favorite movie or TV show set in high school?
Saved by the Bell. I've got pretty much.
God,
every
I knew you were
going to
say
memorized.
That.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Very good, and relevant to the Trump era because Krista, I can't pronounce the name, the Doge guy, not Musk, but said that you shouldn't be. We need more screeches in the world, right? That's what he said.
R.I.P. Screech.
Yes, R.I.P.
No longer
Screech.
With us.
Tina, favorite high school store movie?
Breakfast Club.
There you go.
Classic.
Great one. Lisa, Morella, you guys have any?
What about Never Been Kissed with Drew Barrymore?
Great. Great movie, yeah. With a David Arquette.
Also yeah.
Very good. Morella, do you have a... I think you're still in high school, so you can answer, but
I mean, well, my favorite is actually the Heathers. I like Little Chaos.
Heathers, both the movie and the musical. Good answer. My favorite, of course, being a Canadian, is none other than Degrassi.
Oh God.
See, Junior High, and its sequel.
Oh, just- Degrassi High. Yeah, that was on PBS, wasn't it?
Well, I know it as being on the CBC.
All right.
I'm surprised nobody said Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
No, that was either that or Dazed and Confused.
Yeah.
I was also going to say, I don't know, you guys have seen Can't Hardly Wait. That's another one about the big high school party after graduation.
So mean Girls.
Bueller. No one said Ferris Bueller.
Bueller, no one. Clueless. Yeah, mm-hmm. Right?
Project X.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of Legal Grab Bag. Hard to believe we're only 3 weeks into this year. It feels like it's been a year already. Derek Mullen and Bill Himmelstein. Thanks for joining us. And thank you also to attorney Jerry Singleton of Singleton and Schreiber Injury Attorneys, Georgetown Law Professor David Cole, and music attorney and advisor Kevin Cassini. Let's also give shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stiegel. For Tina Martini, Rich Lentkoff, I'm Brian Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lincoln. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...